Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Monday afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. We're going to stay mostly cloudy through the rest of this afternoon around the valley and a 50% chance for some more rain. Then for tonight, partly cloudy, lows around 50. For tomorrow, sunny and cool with a high of 69. Currently, relative humidity is at 53%. It's partly cloudy and 70 at KJZZ. Meantime, in valley traffic, a collision on the 101 southbound in the East Valley has the Raintree Drive exit closed. On Friday afternoon, Maricopa County Recorder Helen Purcell said ballots for November 8th had been completely counted. So that was only 10 days after the election, and a lot of people were wondering why it took so long. Eric Spencer, Elections Director for the Arizona Secretary of State's office, says state law does not allow counties to count early ballots until 1 week before Election Day.
We have a pretty stringent procedure in place to prevent voter fraud, and that is a pretty diligent signature check on every single ballot that's cast. And with 3.5 million registered voters and roughly over 2 million votes cast, checking every single signature can be a laborious process, and it's not a check-the-box exercise for the counties. They have to find a signature on record that matches that.
Spencer thinks a greater number of voting centers will be a major innovation.
When you can go to vote at any place you like instead of being bound by your precinct, then the provisional ballots nearly disappear in Arizona. Provisional ballots slow down the lines at the polls. They take a lot of time at the county elections office to verify. And so you can eliminate provisionals that way and provide much more convenience to the voter.
Eric Spencer is elections director for the Arizona Secretary of State's office. A number of national elections experts say Arizona is not alone in being perceived as a slow ballot counting state. Among them is David Becker, executive director of the Center for Election Innovation and Research. David, a lot of people are frustrated by what seems like a slow ballot count in Arizona. Is this a significant concern nationally?
It's very understandable that voters would expect that as soon as the polls close, they'd start seeing complete election results. But of course, it's a very big process to get the ballots from all the variety of precincts, as well as the mail ballots, all processed in a way that assures the integrity of all of those ballots. In other words, with all mail ballots, with provisional ballots, those ballots need to be reviewed to make sure that they can confirm that the voter who was supposed to mail in that ballot did mail in that ballot, doing things like comparing signatures and the like. So it's not uncommon at all for there still to be ballots out there to count. I think there's only one state so far that has certified its election results, Wyoming. Every other state still has some remaining ballots to count. California, for instance, has nearly 3 million ballots still to count, nearly 1.5 million of its mail ballots still to count.
Do you think we in the media, whether it's at the local level for statewide races or the national media when it comes to federal races, complicate these things because we want to get the numbers right away, we want to declare a winner even as people may still be in line to vote?
We all want certainty. I mean, it's not just the media, it's just voters. I mean, I work in this field and I've worked in it for two decades. I want to know who won as soon as I possibly can, but I happen to know how election officials are dealing with this. And for those of us who have voted, we know that at the polling place, there's individual polling places all over any individual county, many counties within individual states. All of those ballots need to be counted and aggregated up at the state level, and that's going to take some time. And it seems we only talk about this after presidential elections because that's when all the attention is happening. Election officials are ready for this. They've been planning for this as well as they possibly can. It's actually remarkable that so many of the ballots have been counted. One other thing that's going on right now as well is most of the states are undergoing an audit process where they're making sure that the ballots were counted accurately. So that's happening as well. They're counting every ballot. They're making sure all the ballots are counted as they should have been counted as well with the technology that's out there. So there's a lot that's going on in the election offices that the voters might not be able to see.
David, do you have any reason to think this would happen or that it would be a good idea to make the system a federally run system? Do you think that would in any way improve the counting or the overall system?
There are, of course, some advantages that could come from a more centralized federal system. We would have some standardization across state lines. On the other hand, one of the advantages we have of the state run systems is that, one, they're very difficult to hack because they're all different systems. We've really built a system that almost is impossible for any individual to hack, certainly remotely. And secondly, a lot of the really good ideas that have come out of election administration in the last 20 years have come because a single state just decided to try something rather than we had to wait for Congress to act. A great example that's particularly applicable to Arizona is online voter registration, which Arizona was the first to pioneer back in 2002. That would have never happened if we had had to wait for Congress to act. And since Arizona passed in 2002, there are now 32 states plus D.C. that offer it today, and that number will be closer to 40 states by next year. So that's a remarkable innovation that came about because the states had the freedom to experiment.
David Becker is Executive Director and Co-Founder of the Center for Election Innovation and Research. And David, thank you.
My pleasure, Steve. Thanks.
Governor Doug Ducey has made it clear he wants to reduce income taxes in Arizona every fiscal year he's in office. He's also been someone who has floated the idea of completely eliminating the state income tax. But not everyone in the legislature, Republican or Democrat, agrees with that concept. And here with me to talk more about it is Capital Media Services' Howie Fisher. You talked to the House Speaker-elect J.D. Mesnar. Now, he is someone who wants to see a change in the way the tax rates are done. Now, many people for years have been saying Arizona needs to do something to simplify its tax code. What does Mesnar want to do, and how in conflict is that with what Governor Ducey seems to want to do?
Well, what J.D. would like to do is flatten the rates. So you would have, right now you have five categories from about 2.5% to 4.5%, depending on your adjusted income. Now, this is, you start with your federal adjusted income from line 31 of your federal form. You have some other changes in the state form, the credits, and you can end up with the number. He'd like to take it down to three and ideally to a single rate. Obviously, if you have a single rate, there are people who are paying less than that who would have to pay more, and that's politically unacceptable. So he's got some ideas of having some credits in there for the people at the bottom. What remains to be seen, though, is what are the deductions are going to be available. Now, most of this comes really out of the federal model. In other words, things like interest, how much you pay on dividends, what exemptions there are. So there's not much that the state can do on that. Truthfully, the state taxes are fairly simple as they are now. I mean, you really start with a federal number and you make a few calculations and you come up with a rate. But I think his belief is that with a single rate, it would send a message that Arizona is interested in tax simplification, and that would be good, he believes, for attracting businesses and people to move here.
Now, it's certainly a safe bet that based on who we have as far as the legislature is concerned, with those numbers as far as it leaning toward Republicans, we have a Republican governor, taxes are not going to be raised. But Democrats will counter that, does the state have enough revenue? And legislative leaders for years have been complaining that the voters have tied their hands, that there are certain things that they have to spend money on. There's the structural deficit. What philosophy do you think wins out ultimately when it comes down to this?
As you point out, nobody's going to raise taxes. The only way you raise taxes is taking something to the ballot. So what that means is living within our means. Now, what are our means? Well, you know, this comes down to who gets what tax breaks and what are our needs. Obviously, you have certain built-in things. You have K-12 education, which is over $1 billion a year. You have the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System, which is over $1 billion a year, our Medicaid program. You have Department of Corrections, which is over $1 billion. You have universities. What can you cut? Given that you can't cut anywhere else, where can you expand? When all is said and done, there's probably $25 million that the state has to play with for new programs and or tax cuts. So there's not a lot of wiggle room in there because I don't see, as you point out, any particular move to either increase revenues or cut other kinds of existing spending.
It certainly appears that with Donald Trump in the White House and Republicans in control of both houses of Congress, that there's going to be some move on Obamacare, whether it's repeal, whether it's replace, whatever it may be. How nervous does that make some folks in Arizona, whether it's the governor or others, as far as federal money related to Arizona's Medicaid expansion?
Well, this is hits us on a couple of different levels. You know, number one, we did do Medicaid expansion under Governor Brewer and added about 400,000 people, many of them fully funded by the federal government. To the extent that Obamacare, Affordable Care Act goes away entirely, so does all that Medicaid expansion. Now, the question is, what do you replace it with? Do you replace it with block grants to the states to allow them to fill in? Do you replace it with some sort of credits for people who are above the poverty level but below the threshold now for the expanded, which is about 138% of the federal poverty level? And what about the people who are the working poor, which is really what the Affordable Care Act is designed to fund? And these are not only the people who are in the expanded Medicaid program, but these are the people who have also been buying in the federal health exchanges, with many of them with federal subsidies to at least get some form of insurance. If these people have no insurance, then they're back in the hospital emergency rooms with uncompensated care, and this is the kind of thing that drives hospitals into bankruptcy. And that's the thing I think that truly scares folks on the state level.
Howie Fisher is the man behind Capital Media Services, explaining Arizona taxes to us and the points of view. Howie, thank you and happy Thanksgiving.
And a happy Thanksgiving to you too.
Just a few minutes ago, Governor Doug Ducey announced an agreement with a number of Native American tribes in Arizona that could lead to renegotiating some gaming compacts. KJZZ's Carrie Young attended this afternoon's news conference and joins me now with the latest. Carrie, what do the respective sides get from this? What was announced as far as an agreement is concerned?
Yeah, so what was announced today has a lot to do with that they're opening up negotiations. So right now, nothing is official. It's just agreeing that they will start talks. Kind of what we're looking at is, the big player in this, or what we've heard a lot from, is the Tohono-O-Odham Nation and their casino in the West Valley. What these potential agreements would do would be to allow them to have Class 3 gaming there, but then also reduce the amount of, well, rather not reduce, but keep it so that we're not adding any more casinos in the Phoenix metro area. But tribes are also getting increased numbers of keno games in their casinos, and then also poker tables. They're increasing those numbers. So it's a little bit of a give and take, it seems like.
And this could be a fairly dramatic shift from what Arizona voters approved about 15 years ago as well.
That seems to be the case. These would just be amendments to that 2002 negotiation, but yes.
So one person that was anticipated to be at the press conference, I want you to let us know if he was there, was Representative Trent Franks, who has been outspoken about not being in favor of especially the expansion of Tohono-O-Odham in the West Valley. Did he make any comments?
He did not make any comments. Governor Doug Ducey spoke, and one or two other tribal leaders were speaking, but that was about it. Most of the tribal leaders were just saying that they were excited about the what they were calling modernization of this tribal gaming compact.
So, Carrie, how would you describe the tone of the press conference? Did people seem to be simpatico? I mean, did they seem to be on the same page?
Yeah, I mean, everyone seemed to be excited about this. But then everyone was also reiterating that this is just the start of the negotiations. So they're excited to get talking, I guess.
KJZZ's Carrie Young with an update on Governor Doug Ducey and a possible new agreement related to Native American tribes and gaming in Arizona. Carrie, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
It's the show on 91.5. Along with the takeaways, Todd Zwillick, I'm Steve Goldstein. In the aftermath of 9/11, the Bush administration implemented something called NSEERS. That's the National Security Entry Exit Registration System. That program ran from 2002 until 2011, and under it, certain foreign citizens and nationals within the U.S. had to go to immigration offices for fingerprinting or photos and interviews, and then participate in periodic check-ins. Those certain individuals were not random. The rules applied to people on non-immigrant visas, men over the age of 16, and those from countries that the Bush administration defined as havens for terrorists. 24 of the 25 countries on that list were majority Muslim countries, and inevitably, Muslims were targeted as a result. Then, after numerous court challenges and complaints from Muslim groups, NSEERS was finally dropped. Now Donald Trump appears to be considering bringing that program back or something like it, after running a campaign rife with Islamic-phobic sentiment, from a temporary ban to extreme vetting he described in the campaign.
Well, to be perfectly honest, it is legal. They say it'll hold constitutional muster. I know the ACLU is going to challenge it, but I think it'll pass. And we've done it with Iran back a while ago. We did it during World War II with Japanese, which, call it what you
Come
will,
on.
maybe
you're
wrong.
Not, you're not proposing we go back to the days of internment camps, I hope.
No. I'm not proposing that at all, Megan.
That's Megyn Kelly talking to Trump supporter Carl Higbee, a former Navy SEAL and spokesperson for the pro-Trump Great American PAC, endorsing the idea of a Muslim registry suggested by Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach last week. Kobach is advising the Trump transition on immigration policy. And Donald Trump's future White House chief of staff, Reince Priebus, refused to denounce the idea on Sunday's Meet the Press program with Chuck Todd on NBC.
Can you equivocally rule out a registry for Muslims?
Look, I'm not going to rule out anything, but I wouldn't. We're not going to have a registry based on a religion. But what I think what we're trying to do is say that there are some people, certainly not all people, Chuck. Mm-hmm. There are some people that are radicalized, and there are some people that have to be prevented from coming into this country.
In addition to the possible return of a registry that would focus even indirectly on Muslims, the Trump transition also appears intent to ban immigration from many predominantly Muslim countries. Now, it may not come as a surprise that hate crimes against Muslims spiked last year to the highest level in more than a decade. And now, Muslim and Jewish faith leaders are being forced to reckon with a new reality that seems a lot more like America 50 years ago than it does 2016. Joining me now is Rabbi David Fox Sandmel. He's the Anti-Defamation League's Director of Interreligious Engagement. And also Manaz Afridi. She's Assistant Professor of Religious Studies and Director of the Holocaust, Genocide, and Interfaith Education Center at Manhattan College. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Manaz Afridi, first, this registry, do you interpret it as a registry of Muslims? What message do you think this is sending to Americans?
Well, you know, I mean, the message is rhetorical, and there's a lot of fear in the Muslim community. There's a lot of confusion. We've experienced Islamophobia since 9/11. It's not a new sentiment in the United States, but at the same time, it's very fearful. I mean, for example, my own child is scared that I'm going to get deported because one of the countries that's listed is Pakistan, and I'm from Pakistan. However, I'm a U.S. citizen, abiding citizen, and actually peacemaker in the United States.
Rabbi Sandmel, government lists based on religion are a thing that immediately get the attention of a lot of Jews.
This is something that the Jewish community has experienced in Nazi Germany, and it, of course, raises concerns. I don't want to go to the point of drawing analogies between the 1930s and today. There are lots of differences, but on an emotional level, when we hear these sort of things, it certainly raises concerns. And the Manaz was speaking about her daughter. I've had conversations with a number of Muslim colleagues who have told almost the exact same story about their children. And when I think about children's sense of security being shaken in that way, I find that very distressing and disheartening.
It's interesting with both of you, as soon as I asked about this proposed policy, neither of your answers had much to do with policy. This is a rhetorical problem and a cultural problem that seems to reach back to the campaign and now into the transition with Donald Trump himself and now his surrogates drawing bright lines between groups of people and engaging in rhetoric that seems to set Muslims apart as an other, quite apart from whether such a registry would be effective.
Let me just say, I educate students, young, very bright students at Manhattan College, and I run a center, and I teach Islam, and I teach the Holocaust. So I deal with both Islamophobia and anti-Semitism. So one of the things that I have understood as a scholar and as a Muslim American is that rhetoric, mythologizing of the other, is a very deep problem in our culture. I would implore people and politicians to watch out for rhetoric that causes fear amongst groups and has caused more Islamophobia and anti-Semitism in the last week or so.
Rabbi Sandmel, one of the observations in the last week or two during the transition, I've seen people online counting the number of tweets and statements, for instance, that Donald Trump has made about Hamilton the musical or about other various things in the culture. But none of those were denouncing any of the public displays of Islamophobia or anti-Semitism that we've seen around the country.
Well, I think one of the roles of our leaders, this is all our leaders, our government leaders, religious leaders, is to send the right message to all the citizens of our country. And so one of my concerns here is that while I think there is probably a distinction between the positions of President-elect Trump and some of those who support him, the fact that he has not been clearer in his denunciation of this kind of both rhetoric and action gives me pause.
Mehnaz Afridi, there's something to reckon with here as we've talked about the rhetoric that Donald Trump and his surrogates have used. Millions and millions of people voted for this candidate, internalizing the rhetoric that he used, or simply ignoring it, saying they're in a way that they're fine with it because they support some other aspect of the program. And we have to reckon with the attitudes that tens of millions of Americans seem to have about their fellow Muslim Americans.
Yeah, I mean, look, if people supported Trump, I don't have a problem with them. They're human beings, they're citizens, they had all kinds of reasons to support Trump. And I stand equally with them as an American. But the whole idea of fear is also not mentioned. A lot of people in the United States are fearful of Muslims. They're fearful of ISIS. They're fearful of Al-Qaeda. They're fearful of Boko Haram. A very small percentage of my people are extremists. Very small percentage of my people are going to cause the extremism that, you know, the fear is played on. However, what's really interesting to me is that since 9/11, there has been so many misunderstandings about Islam. And you would think that after 9/11, we would go out and we'd really find out who these 1.6 billion people are. But we still haven't done our homework. And it's challenging and it's frustrating for me. I mean, I know we still certainly haven't done our homework for anti-Semitism. I teach the Holocaust. So here I am, you know, faced with a new reality, so dealing with two others in the United States. But I also want to say that we as people will not let hard-lined policies that are racist, that are blatantly against a group of people, come into being. I believe in this administration, and I believe in the next administration, that we as Americans are going to come together with alliances like the Jews and Muslims and others to stop these policies. And I really believe in the people of the United States.
Let's talk about action for a second. Jonathan Greenblatt is the CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, your organization. He went on television and said that if there is any kind of Muslim registry in this country, that Jonathan Greenblatt would register as a Muslim. Will you do the same?
Absolutely. I think that the message that sends is any action, any law that curtails the rights of any particular individual or any particular group affects all of us.
Is that heartening, Mehnaz Afridi?
Yes, absolutely. I want to just say a few things about action. There's a lot of really good work being done between Jews and Muslims, and I don't think the public really knows how hard we work together. They only see the trouble in the Middle East. And this is the rhetoric that should be out there. This good work, this community organizing should be out there. Why are we fixated on negativity and fear?
But
and
talk this is about, a concern. I want to interrupt you because talk about the importance of this alternative rhetoric. It's nice to hold hands. It's nice to be nice. Interfaith dialogue is nice. There's a strategic imperative here, which is the more that the government can get people from these different groups to cooperate, the easier it is to prevent the people who are extremists from engaging in terrorism. It's easier to catch people if more people cooperate, if you have more eyes and ears.
Well, I mean, I'm going to a little critique with your language. Catch people. That kind of language is, you know, it's kind of offensive to Muslims or Jews. I mean, who are you catching? What are you catching for? Under former President Bush, we also had a policy that vetted Muslims. So, I mean, is that the policy or what is the registry about? I mean, to say that all Muslims have to register or there are 7 or 8 countries where people come move back and forth is a whole different story. And I want some clarity on that. Now, I want to also talk about this feel good. You know, sitting with Jews and Muslims is not a feel good thing, especially when you're challenged with issues of Israel, when you're challenged with issues of Palestine, when you're challenged with issues of extremism. So the work that we're doing is challenging. It's not feel good. We don't just have interfaith dinners and walk out. We have really hard conversations and challenges. But we also share one thing, and that is the dream of being American and living here and showing to our children. That's so important. That Jews, Muslims, Christians, Buddhists, anyone else, Zoroastrians, Hindus, atheists even, are all human beings. And we live here and share this dream together. And I think that if you want to talk about feel good, well, certainly people are not feeling good. So I guess that's been accomplished by the rhetoric today by the politician.
Rabbi David Fox Sanmel is the Anti-Defamation League's Director of Interreligious Engagement. And Mena Zafridi is Assistant Professor of Religious Studies and Director of the Holocaust, Genocide, and Interfaith Education Center at Manhattan College. Thanks to you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's Todd Zwillick at The Takeaway. U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services is giving new guidance that's intended to clarify how it determines if someone's family is going to experience, quote, extreme hardship if that person is not admitted into this country. The agency has discretion, and the new guidance is intended to clarify what conditions need to be met. Some have expressed concern the current vagueness has kept a number of people in the shadows rather than taking a chance on asking for an extreme hardship qualifier and potentially being deported. Evelyn Cruz is a clinical law professor at ASU's O'Connor College of Law and is with me to explain. Evelyn, we often hear about there being a so-called line for immigrants who want to become citizens. Is there really such a thing?
There are a couple different quote-unquote lines. The biggest ones of the lines are the ones related to family petitions, the ones that I indicated, and the ones related to employment visas. Those are the largest chunk. And then we have small programs such as the asylum program, someone who gets asylum, or visas related to investors, for example. They kind of have their own little niche. So there is a very small percentage of individuals who can utilize those visas. You have to have an established family relationship in the United States. Or for the employment visas, you have to be in an area where we don't have enough workers in that area.
So let's talk about what's going on December 5th. USCIS is going to define extreme hardship. Is that defined now?
The process for someone to be vetted as to whether or not we allow them into the country requires that the Immigration Service establish whether or not there's a ground that bars them from coming in, and then evaluate whether or not there is a waiver available to them, because we feel that not allowing them to come in would create an extreme hardship for a family member here in the United States. Mm. And that term is very loaded. We have had over the years different case law, different standards, different discussions as to what it means to establish extreme hardship. And most of it was very much in the peripheral because it wasn't as utilized in the past as it is now. Now, pretty much every single one of those waivers requires that the person establish an extreme hardship. So it was pivotal for USCIS to give some guidance as to how they're going to evaluate it. After all, Congress gives them the power to establish parameters for that evaluation.
So what would be on the list potentially of extreme hardship?
So the list that they have created, it's not a checklist per se, because it's very difficult. They outright admit from the very beginning that this is a very individualized evaluation. They do provide some basic ideas of what kind of things we're looking for, mm-hmm. Things involving the fact that this individual is the primary breadwinner. That someone has health issues and this person will be necessary in the United States to help provide care. That this person is fundamental to this person's ability to continue to be a contributing member of society. And the waiver is not available for every activity that the person has done. It's very particularized. We will never have a waiver for someone who is a terrorist, even if it would be the extreme, unusual, hardest hardship. We would not waive that.
So how impactful do you think this change could be, specifically Arizona, but across the country? You mentioned how it would be nice to have the same rules in Wichita, Kansas, as Mesa, Arizona. Is that the biggest impact we're going to feel?
That is the biggest impact. Obviously, there are places where they're being very harsh on these waivers, so they will see a change for the better. And there's places where they're being very lax on these waivers, and people will feel that the door has been closed on them. My general feeling of the Arizona spectrum is that they tend to be pretty fair here on a lot of these waivers. And sometimes when they have had confusion, they have kicked it up, if you will, up to the D.C. office to try to evaluate. And if anything, now it's going to be decided a little faster because they will have an ability to make the decision sooner with what they have instead of having to kick it up to the D.C. office.
Evelyn Cruz is a clinical law professor at ASU's O'Connor College of Law. We've been discussing possible changes by U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. Many women who voted for Hillary Clinton saw the 2016 presidential election as a chance to make history, but Clinton didn't become the first woman to be elected president of the United States, and now that loss has mobilized millions of those women to take action. It started as an invite-only Facebook group called Pantsuit Nation, a nod to Clinton's signature outfit choice, and it has quickly spread. The show's Lauren Gilger went to the first meeting of Arizona's Pantsuit Nation chapter this weekend. And Lauren, just how many people were involved?
In the 2 weeks since the election, the main Facebook group has grown to nearly 4 million members nationally. And here in Arizona, 800 people came to the first Pantsuit Nation meeting in Tempe on Sunday. Because of the turnout, they actually couldn't fit everyone who registered into the meeting due to fire code, so they had to hold a second meeting. And when I walked in, there was a line of women, some there with their young daughters, going all the way out the door. So everyone got a name tag and then filed down a long table covered in sign-up sheets to pick a subcommittee they wanted to join.
This is Phoenix. It ends right there with Tempe.
Women's rights and reproductive rights, so that's been a big issue. Interfaith outreach has had a big outcry. Black Lives Matter has had a big outcry. Environmental protection, education, and children's services.
I talked with a few of the women who started this group between their meetings, and they told me they were devastated on election night when it became clear that Clinton had lost, but they quickly decided to turn it into action.
I think for me it was sort of a little bit disappointment, sadness, and then that call to act. I felt, especially in that moment, that I couldn't take this one lying down. Like, to me, it was not the same as, say, other elections. And so it was like, I need to do something. Like, I need to channel this disappointment into action.
I will say, I think this also, it really prompted me to start looking at the people that represent us in our government. And as I started to do that research, I didn't feel like I was being properly represented in my own government. And there was a part of me that hoping that Hillary would win would be part of that representation. And I think when that didn't happen, it really started to be this glaringly obvious thing that women are so not represented in their government.
I think we all sort of went through stages of grief, certainly. There was a lot of tears shed in my house on election night, but something that I think we need to keep in mind, I'm a middle-class white woman. I'm coming from a different place of privilege than some of the marginalized groups that Trump and his supporters have targeted through their divisive rhetoric, and now their increase in hate crime activity. I can't be grieving. I have to stand up and advocate for those who are in immediate danger. So after kind of drying my eyes the next morning, I immediately reached out to Jamie and said, what can we do? Can we make a state chapter? How can we harness this momentum? People are upset. People want to do something. How can we organize and get to work?
That was Kelsey O'Neill, Erin Van Loo, and Cassie Chilton, three of the women who are organizing Arizona's Pantsuit Nation chapter. None of these women are politicians either. They don't even work in politics. Kelsey's a stay-at-home mom. Erin is a school psychologist, and Cassie is a full-time student. They all said they just realized that no one else was going to do it if they didn't do it, so they got involved.
So you mentioned they had 800 people there yesterday. What are the goals going forward?
So they say they're starting local, forming these subcommittees for people to join, and then that will shift as the election season approaches again. Here's Cassie Chilton.
We're trying to organize people based on the causes that they're passionate about and the areas that they're in, and form subcommittees so that they can organize locally and make action plans in their community. Certainly as we approach election season, our focus is going to shift more towards civic engagement and voter turnout and supporting candidates who align with progressive values.
They're also looking into forming a political action committee so that they can raise money to fund local campaigns for progressive candidates.
And is this exclusively a female group?
They say it's not. There were a few men interspersed throughout the crowd yesterday, and the group leaders told me anyone who believes in equal rights is welcome. But they all said that women's rights are central to what they're doing here, and that being a woman during this election was different than it ever had been before for them. Here's Erin Van Loo again.
I think you would hear an outcry across the nation that being a woman in this election means, it just meant so much more. It was a much deeper level this time. We had an emotional investment, and when it
when it all fell apart that Tuesday night / Wednesday morning, I think we saw a lot of opportunities for our voices to be heard slipping away. And collectively, as a group, individually, we started to decide, you know, nobody's going to do this for us. We're going to have to start being that voice. We can't expect someone else to stand up and be that voice. We need to be that voice.
And that's the show's Lauren Gilger. Lauren, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
The Maricopa County Sheriff's Office will be undergoing dramatic changes soon when the sheriff-elect Paul Penzone takes over from Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Modifications on many levels are expected because Arpaio has dominated the agency for nearly a quarter century. How many of those changes will be cultural and how many will be practical? To talk about that, I'm joined by Michael Scott, clinical professor in the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at ASU. Michael, how does the outcome of the election immediately affect the agency as well as rank-and-file employees?
Well, initially, the main initial reaction is uncertainty, and this happens in every police agency where there's going to be a new executive. There'll be a period of time before the new executive comes into office in which people in the organization as well as people outside it are speculating and wondering and very interested to know what does the new boss want, and more particularly, how does what the new boss wants, how is it likely to affect me?
So even with those who may have been loyalists, wouldn't one think that there should be some kind of changes just based on how things have been going? Does that make anything easier, the idea that, okay, well, it's been 25 years, so logically there could be some things we modify?
Much depends on who the heir apparent or the successor is. And in this particular case, the expectation is going to be that there will be a lot of change. And that's partly informed. It's easier to anticipate that in a sheriff's office because it's an elected position. Mm. And there have already been months and months and months of public discussions by both candidates about what direction they would take the office. That doesn't happen as much in a police agency. So in a sheriff's office, the employees and the public alike have a better sense of what they could expect depending on who gets elected.
When it comes to actual practice, though, actual law enforcement practices, are those less likely to change? I mean, would we expect that because law enforcement is law enforcement, or is there a difference? Can that difference be felt by a leader change as well? Not just what the priorities are, but how people go about their daily business.
Absolutely, that can change because law enforcement is not law enforcement as much as we might like to think it is. There are some voluntary national standards, accreditation standards, but they are not binding. So all the law enforcement agencies across the United States do not necessarily adhere to the same set of guidelines or rules other than the U.S. Constitution. And what that means is that in American policing, exactly how policing is done on the street, with the rules, the regulations, the policies, the equipment, the training, who gets hired, all varies considerably from police agency to police agency across 18,000-some police agencies.
Regardless of whether it is because Sheriff Penzone would want to make changes or because people may decide, I'm not sure I want to work for someone other than Sheriff Arpaio, would you expect there'd be a lot of turnover?
I think probably at the line level, unlikely. If you have a job as a deputy sheriff, much as with being a police officer, typically it's a good job. It's a reasonably well-paying job with decent benefits. It's not something a person would want to give up too easily. Usually you don't find people voluntarily leaving en masse, but again, sometimes they're compelled to leave by a sheriff if they have that authority. But I think most employees are going to would give the incoming sheriff the benefit of the doubt. Now, that can change a bit at the higher ranks. Mm.
Could this be good for that agency to have a new leader, at least in terms of public perception of the agency?
I think it's good for every police agency to have new leaders periodically. Now, how frequently that ought to occur is a matter of a lot of debate. There are some states in the United States where police chiefs last for 25 or more years as well because they also have significant job security. And so we sort of know that changing police executives every year or every 2 years, which is not uncommon in some places, is not beneficial. That's too much change too quickly. It doesn't allow for stability, for continuity, for the development of professionalism. But having police chiefs or sheriffs for longer than 20 years tends to stagnate the organizations. And it's somewhat easy for those organizations to sort of fall behind national trends and practices and professional principles because they become a little bit too insular.
Michael Scott is a clinical professor in the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at ASU. We've been talking about what changes may take place in the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office. The National Football League is holding Monday Night Football in Mexico City tonight as the Houston Texans take on the Oakland Raiders. The league plays several games a year in London, but this is another step as the NFL tries to expand its global reach. So regardless of who's ahead on the scoreboard when the game ends tonight, is this going to be a win or a loss for the NFL? With me to talk about that is Dan Kaplan of the Sports Business Journal. Dan, is this just another step in the NFL's plan for world domination, first London, now Mexico City?
Well, it is a big deal for the NFL. It is the first Monday night football game not in the United States, so that makes it a big deal. The game sold out within 30 minutes at the stadium in Mexico City. In terms of where it fits, the NFL clearly, since 2007, has been focused on playing regular season games in London. They've played, my math may be a little off, but anywhere between 15 and 20 games since then at Wembley Stadium and one at the Twickenham rugby facility outside of London. So there had been some thought that they were focused fully on London. Clearly, that's not the case. Mexico City now could become an annual game, and the head of NFL International recently talked about having regular season games elsewhere, whether it be Canada or even Berlin.
So, Dan, where does Mexico City fit in specifically when it comes to actual love of the NFL? Do we know? Because sometimes even with those London games, it feels like the crowds are there because it's an event, but, you know, do they really love the game?
Definitely in London, you get this sort of rainbow of NFL colors at the stadium where you have the fans of many different teams coming out to the game, and it's sort of an event. It's a celebration of the NFL, but there's not necessarily a passionate following of the teams. Interestingly, after almost a decade of trying to groom a new generation of fans in London, in the UK, the NFL's research still shows there's more avid fans in Mexico than there are in the United Kingdom. The NFL says there's 25 million avid fans, and Mexico City has a population of 22 million, so there's not an issue of having fans show up for an isolated game like there is tonight. I think for the NFL, the question is, could you do this on a regular basis? Could you do this once or twice a year? And what more can you do to grow the fan base in Mexico?
And Dan, if it isn't any more than that, if it isn't any more than a game or two a year and there isn't a plan to expand, let's say, if Mexico City doesn't actually get its own NFL team, is there a way to measure how this benefits Mexico or Mexico City? Because I think that's a question a lot of people have, which is, okay, it makes a lot of sense for the NFL, but for that individual market to host a game or two, does it really benefit them in any solid way?
Well, I mean, there are NFL fans in Mexico. It's an event for the stadium to put on. I mean, whether it's a venue in the United States, Mexico, Germany, Asia, they're always looking for content for being, you know, something to put on. So it's a big spectacle that they're able to sell 90 to 100,000 tickets for. So I don't see it as a negative for Mexico. And clearly, if it's sold out, there's a demand for the product.
Do we have any idea? Is it a broad range of prices? Has the NFL tried to be conscious of that as well to make sure that a whole array of fans could be able to see some of these international games?
They're price conscious to the sensitivities of the market, for sure. They don't want to price themselves out of the market. But like any sporting event, there are fans who will not be able to afford to go to a game.
Dan Kaplan of the Sports Business Journal. We've been talking about tonight's Monday night football game between the Houston Texans and Oakland Raiders taking place in Mexico City. And Dan, thank you for the time.
All right, thank you.
Americans have a unique relationship with their cars, and our automobiles and the open road have long been a great subject and tool for fiction. In the new anthology, The Highway Kind, Valley-based editor Patrick Milliken has collected new tales by authors like Michael Connelly, George Pelicanos, Diana Gabaldon, and James Salas. Every one of the stories has something to do with cars. Milliken and writer James Salas are with me to talk about the compilation. Patrick, let me start with you. Why was this topic something that appealed to you, and how did you get so many prominent writers to collaborate with you on it?
Well, I had the idea of the car anthology just because cars and crime fiction are so connected and have been for a long time. It's interesting how I got these authors to sign up. You know, I've been working at the Poison Pen here in Scottsdale for 21 years now, and just the right place, the right time. You know, had a lot of contacts, and I was shooting for a real diverse cast too, not just crime writers. Mm-hmm. And so we got a really great mix in this book.
Some writers like Raymond Chandler, even John Talton, will say, oh, the city really plays a role in it. Certainly from reading the stories, the car plays a very different role in each story. Did you even think about the idea of actually having the car as a character per se, whether an obvious character or just sort of in the background?
It's funny you say that because the concept for the book kind of morphed. You know, at first I envisioned this, you know, kind of interesting collection where each writer would pick a different car and the car would really be the focus of the story. It morphed into something, at least to my mind, much more interesting. As the stories started coming in, you know, we realized early on that they had this almost confessional tone. They were very personal. Mm-hmm. I started to realize that there was another element to this, that most of us, at least out in the West, you know, we spend a significant portion of our time alone in our cars. You know, the opportunity for all sorts of criminal situations was there. You know, it's they kind of, as I say in the introduction, the cars represent or facilitate our secret lives. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the stories kind of go into that.
Now, Jim, you had a great career before this, but one thing that put you on the map for a more mainstream audience was Drive and the success of the film, and Ryan Gosling and Albert Brooks are in this film. And I want to talk about your specific story, which harkens back a little bit to that. How did you feel about writing about cars as fiction? Was that something that intrigued you from a young age, even as you're writing poetry?
No, it didn't. And I know nothing about cars, as I keep explaining to people, because they expect me to, since they put all of that research into the books. With Drive, I had the character, and he was a driver, so I had to at least pretend that I knew something about cars. And with the story, which is, you find out partway through the story that it's a young person meeting driver when he's at the end of the book, apparently, and before he dies. I had never written a story about cars before, as far as I know, but I've written a couple since. And I had never written a story about a young person. I'd always kind of shied away from that. So this was a perfect idea. Patrick and I had talked about it from inception, and I gave my automatic response. I can't write stories to order. But as I said the other night, I was in New York, and my editor stood me up. So I was sitting in a coffee shop, and I was feeling sorry for myself and unloved. And suddenly, the idea of the story came to me, and I got a piece of paper and started writing. And then it turned into a story, of which I'm very, very proud, because it's quite unlike anything I've written before.
And your story in The Highway Kind is called What You Were Fighting For. Paragraphs like this: everyone assumed I'd follow in my father's footsteps, work at the tire factory maybe, or with luck and a long, stubborn climb uphill, become like he had a mechanic. No one called kids special back in those days. We got called lots of things, but special wasn't among them. This is before I found out why normal things were so hard for me, why I always had no push when others didn't. This is dropped into a less than 10-page short story, presumably about the main character from Drive. So how do you do this?
I listen. I'm very quiet, and I listen, and this stuff happens. And when it happens, it's really as though pianos are falling on you from the second floor or something. You know, with that, I didn't want to back off from it, but I didn't want to be too explicit. And as you find, I think, on the penultimate page, he's suddenly in a wheelchair, mm-hmm. and he's an adult.
Physical therapy is just sort of randomly mentioned.
These were gifts. Yeah. These were gifts to me as mm-hmm. I wrote and listened to this person tell me his story. Mm-hmm. And that's why I write.
Well, and Patrick, as we mentioned, you've got a variety of authors in here. How much freedom did you give the writers?
Absolute freedom. Okay. You know, it's funny because I had this very kind of vague and nebulous idea. I just said, the theme here is cars, driving, and the road. I think that's what elicited such an interesting variety. I didn't kind of impose any particular type of story, you know. Some of them are dark, some of them are not dark, some of them are comic. You know, they're set in all different time periods. Mm-hmm. But I must confess, I just kind of approached a bucket list of all my favorite writers, you know, and there were a few that, you know, were outside of the crime genre. You know, some of my favorites in the story are by writers that aren't associated with crime fiction at all. Mm-hmm. Like there's a guy named Willie Vlauten, who's a really, really wonderful novelist, kind of under the radar, and a musician. He turned in this absolutely fantastic short story that has something to do with the car, kinda, sorta. But they're really stories, you know, just great stories. It's almost like, you know, creating the ultimate mixtape, you know, because you're you get all these stories and you try to craft a narrative with these different stories and take the reader on a kind of a journey.
Patrick Milliken is the editor of the anthology The Highway Kind, Tales of Fast Cars, Desperate Drivers, and Dark Roads. He was also the editor of the anthology Phoenix Noir. And Jim Salas is a novelist. His latest is Will Not. He's featured in the anthology as well. Guys, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Steve.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.